and I'll give her a good one. Bring her next time, shall I?"
"Yeah, sure."
They went to the door. Marina was talking with Boo and Orlov as the two men lifted cartons of canned goods from the trunk. But she wasn't just talking. She was flirting a little, too. Boo looked ready to fall on his knees. On the porch, Lee said something about the FBI. DeMorenschild asked him how many times. Lee held up three fingers. One agent called Fane. He came twice. Another named Hosty.
"Look them right in the eye and answer the questions," DeMorenschild said. "You have nothing to fear, Lee. Not just because you are innocent, but because you are in the right."
The others were looking at him now, and not just them. The jump rope girls had appeared, standing in the rut that served as a sidewalk on our block of Mercedes Street. DeMorenschild had an audience and was declaiming to it.
"You are ideologically dedicated, young Mr. Oswald, so of course they come. The Hoover Gang. For all we know, they're watching now. Perhaps from down the block. Perhaps from that house right across the street."
DeMorenschild stabbed his finger at my drawn drapes. Lee turned to look. I stood still in the shadows, glad I'd put down the sound-enhancing Tupperware bowl, even though it was now coated with black tape.
"I know who they are. Haven't they and their CIA first cousins been to visit me on many occasions, trying to browbeat me into informing on my Russian and South American friends? After the war, didn't they call me a closet Nazi? Haven't they claimed I hired the Tonton Macoute to beat and torture my competitors for oil leases in Haiti? Didn't they accuse me of bribing Papa Doc and paying for the Trujillo assassination? Yes, yes, all of that and more."
The jump rope girls were staring at him with their mouths open. So was Marina. Once he got going, George DeMorenschild swept everything before him.
"Be courageous, Lee. When they come, stand forward. Show them this."
He grasped his shirt and tore it open. Buttons popped off and clattered to the porch. The jump rope girls gasped, too shocked to giggle. Unlike most American men of that time, DeMorenschild wore no undershirt. His skin was the color of oiled mahogany. Fatty breasts hung on old muscle. He pounded his right fist above his left nipple.
"Tell them, here is mine heart. And mine heart is pure. And mine heart belongs to my cows. Tell them, even if Hoover rips my heart out of me, it will still beat, and 1,000 others will beat in time. Then 10,000. Then 100,000. Then 1,000,000.
Orlov put down the box of canned goods he was holding so he could offer a round of light, satiric applause. Marina's cheeks were flaming with color. Lee's face was the most interesting one. Like Paul of Tarsus on the Damascus Road, he'd had a revelation. The blindness had dropped from his eyes. DeMorenschild's preaching and shirt-ripping antics, not so very different from the tent-show shenanigans of the right-wing evangelists he reviled, were deeply troubling to me. I had hoped that if I could listen in on a heart-to-heart between the two men, it might go a long way toward eliminating DeMorenschild as a real factor in the Walker attempt, and hence, the Kennedy assassination. I'd gotten the heart-to-heart, but it made things worse instead of better. One thing seemed clear. It was time to bid Mercedes Street a not-so-fond adieu. I had rented the ground-floor apartment at 214 West Neely. On the 24th of September, I packed up my aging Ford Sunliner with my few clothes, my books, and my typewriter, and moved them to Dallas. The two fat ladies had left behind a sick-room, stenchy pigsty. I did the cleanup myself, thanking God that Al's rabbit hole emerged in a time when aerosol air freshener was available. I bought a portable TV at a yard sale and plunked it down on the kitchen counter next to the stove, which I thought of as the repository of antique grease. As I swept, washed, scrubbed, and sprayed, I watched crime shows like The Untouchables and sitcoms like Car 54, Where Are You? When the thumps and shouts of the kids upstairs quit for the night, I turned in and slept like the dead. There were no dreams. I held on to my place on Mercedes Street, but didn't see much at 2703. Sometimes Marina popped June into a stroller, another gift from her elderly admirer, Mr. Boo, and rolled her up to the warehouse parking lot and back again. In the afternoons, after school let out, the jump rope girls often accompanied them. Marina even jumped herself a couple of times, chanting in Russian. The sight of her mother pogoing up and down with that great cloud of dark hair flying made the baby laugh. The jump rope girls laughed too. Marina didn't mind. She talked a lot with them and never looked irritated when they giggled and corrected her. She looked pleased, in fact. Lee didn't want her to learn English, but she was learning it anyway. Good for her. On October 2nd, 1962, I woke to eerie silence in my Neely Street apartment. No running feet overhead. No young mother yelling at the older two to get ready for school. They had moved out in the middle of the night. I went upstairs and tried my key on their door. It didn't work, but the lock was of the spring variety, and I popped it easily with a coat hanger. I spied an empty bookcase in the living room. I drilled a small hole in the floor, plugged in the second bugged lamp, and fed the tap wire through the hole and into my downstairs apartment. Then I moved the bookcase over it. The bug worked fine, but the reels of the cunning little Japanese tape recorder only turned when prospective tenants came to look at the apartment and happened to try the lamp. There were lookers, but no takers. Until the Oswalds moved in, I had the Neely Street address entirely to myself. After the bumptious carnival that was Mercedes Street, that was a relief, although I kind of missed the jump rope girls. They were my Greek chorus. I slept in my Dallas apartment at night and watched Marina stroll the baby in Fort Worth by day. While I was so occupied, another 60s watershed moment was approaching, but I ignored it. I was preoccupied with the Oswalds, who were undergoing another domestic spasm. Lee came home early from work one day during the second week of October. Marina was out walking June. They spoke at the foot of the driveway across the street. Near the end of the conversation, Marina spoke in English. "What is Ledov mean?" he explained in Russian. Marina spread her hands in a what-can-you-do gesture and hugged him. Lee kissed her cheek, then took the baby out of the stroller. June laughed as he held her high over his head, her hands reaching down to tug at his hair. They went inside together. Happy little family, bearing up under temporary adversity. That lasted until 5 in the afternoon. I was getting ready to drive back to Neely Street when I spied Marguerite Oswald approaching from the bus stop on Winscott Road. Here comes trouble, I thought, and how right I was. Once again, Marguerite avoided the still unrepaired ha-ha step. Once more, she entered without knocking. Fireworks followed immediately. It was a warm evening, and the windows were open over there. I didn't bother with the distance mic. Lee and his mother argued at full volume. He hadn't been laid off from his job at Leslie Welding after all, it seemed. He had just walked away. The boss called Veda Oswald, looking for him, because they were short-handed, and when he got no help from Robert's wife, he called Marguerite.
"I lied for you, Lee," Marguerite shouted. "I said you had the flu. Why do you always make me lie for you?"
"I don't make you do nothing,"
he shouted back. They were standing nose to nose in the living room.
"I don't make you do nothing, and you do it anyway."
"Lee, how are you going to support your family? You need a job."
Oh, I'll get a job. Don't you worry about that, Ma.
Where?
I don't know. Oh, Lee, how'll you pay the rent?
But she's got plenty of friends.
He jerked a thumb at Marina, who flinched. They aren't good for much, but they'll be good for that. You need to get out of here, Ma. Go back home. Let me catch my breath.
Marguerite darted to the playpen.
Where'd this hair come from?
The friends I told you about. Half of 'em's rich and the rest are trying.
They like to talk to Rena,
Lee sneered. The older ones like to ogle her tits.
Lee!
Shocked voice, but a look on her face that was pleased.
Was Mamushka pleased at the fury she heard in her son's voice?
Go on, Ma, give us some peace. Does she understand that men who give things always want things in return? Does she, Lee? Get the hell out!
Shaking his fists, almost dancing in his impotent rage,
Marguerite smiled.
You're upset. Of course you are. I'll come back when you're feeling more in control of yourself, and I'll help. I always want to help.
Then abruptly, she rushed at Marina and the baby. It was as if she meant to attack them. She covered June's face with kisses, then strode across the room. At the door, she turned and pointed at the playpen.
Tell her to scrub that down, Lee. People's cast-offs always have germs. If the baby gets sick, you'll never be able to afford the doctor.
Ma, go.
I am, just now.
Calm as cookies and milk, she twiddled her fingers in a girlish ta-ta gesture, and off she went. Marina approached Lee, holding the baby like a shield. They talked. Then they shouted. Family solidarity was gone with the wind. Marguerite had seen to that. Lee took the baby, rocked her in the crook of one arm, then, with absolutely no warning, punched his wife in the face. Marina went down, bleeding from the mouth and nose and crying loudly. Lee looked at her. The baby was also crying. Lee stroked June's fine hair, kissed her cheek, rocked her some more. Marina came back into view, struggling to her feet. Lee kicked her in the side, and down she went again. I could see nothing but the cloud of her hair. Leave him, I thought, even though I knew she wouldn't. Take the baby and leave him. Go to George Boo, warm his bed if you have to, but get away from that skinny, mother-ridden monster, post-haste. But it was Lee who left her, at least temporarily. I never saw him on Mercedes Street again. It was their first separation. Lee went to Dallas to look for work. I don't know where he stayed. According to Al's notes, it was the Y, but that turned out to be wrong. Maybe he found a place in one of the cheap rooming houses downtown. I wasn't concerned. I knew they'd show up together to rent the apartment above me, and for the time being, I'd had enough of him. It was a treat not to have to listen to his slowed-down voice saying, "I know it," a dozen times in every conversation. Thanks to George Boo, Marina landed on her feet. Not long after Marguerite's visit and Lee's decampment, Boo and another man arrived in a Chevy truck and moved her out. When the pickup left 2703 Mercedes, mother and daughter were riding in the bed. The pink suitcase Marina had brought from Russia had been lined with blankets, and June lay fast asleep in this makeshift nest. Marina put a steadying hand on the little girl's chest as the truck started rolling. The jump rope girls were watching, and Marina waved to them. They waved back. I found George Demorenschild's address in the Dallas White Pages and followed him several times. I was curious about whom he might meet, although if it were a CIA man, a minion of the Lansky mob, or some other possible conspirator, I doubt I would have known it. All I can say is that he met no one that seemed suspicious to me. He went to work, He went to the Dallas Country Club, where he played tennis or swam with his wife. They went out to a couple of strip clubs. He didn't bother the dancers, but had a penchant for fondling his wife's boobs and butt in public. She didn't seem to mind. On two occasions he met with Lee. Once it was at DeMorenschild's favorite strip club. Lee seemed uncomfortable with the milieu, and they didn't stay long. The second time they had lunch in a Browder Street coffee shop. There they remained until almost 2 p.m, talking over endless cups of coffee. Lee started to get up, reconsidered, and ordered something else. The waitress brought him a piece of pie, and he handed her something, which she put in her apron pocket after a cursory glance. Instead of following when they left, I approached the waitress and asked if I could see what the young man had given her. "You can have it," she said, and gave me a sheet of yellow paper with black tabloid letters at the top. "Hands off Cuba." It urged interested persons to join the Dallas-Fort Worth branch of this fine organization. "Don't let Uncle Sam dupe you. Write to P.O. Box 1919 for details of future meetings." "What did they talk about?" I asked. "Are you a cop?" "No, I tip better than the cops," I said, and handed her a $5 bill. "That stuff," she said, and pointed at the flyer, which Oswald had undoubtedly printed off at his new place of employment. "Cuba, like I give a shit." But on the night of October 22nd, less than a week later, President Kennedy was also talking about Cuba. And then, everybody gave a shit. It's a blues truism that you never miss your water until the well runs dry. But until the fall of 1962, I didn't realize that also applied to the patter of little feet shaking your ceiling. With the family from upstairs gone, 214 West Neely took on a creepy, haunted house vibe. I miss Sadie, and began to worry about her almost obsessively. On second thought, you can strike the almost. Ellie Dougherty and Deke Simmons didn't take my concern about her husband seriously. Sadie herself didn't take it seriously. For all I knew, she thought I was trying to scare her about John Clayton in order to keep her from pushing me entirely out of her life. None of them knew that if you removed the Sadie part, her name was only a syllable away from Doris Dunning. None of them knew about the harmonic effect which I seemed to be creating myself just by my presence in the land of a go. That being the case, who would be to blame if something happened to Sadie? The bad dreams started to come back. The gym lot dreams. I quit keeping tabs on George DeMorenschild and started taking long walks that began in the afternoon and didn't finish up back at West Neely Street until 9 or even 10 o'clock at night. I spent them thinking about Lee, now working as a photoprint trainee at a Dallas graphic arts company called Jagger's Child Stovall. Or about Marina, who had taken up temporary residence with a newly divorced woman named Alina Hall. The Hall woman worked for George Boo's dentist, and it was the dentist who had been behind the wheel of the pickup on the day Marina and June moved out of the dump on Mercedes Street. Mostly what I thought about was Sadie, and Sadie, and Sadie. On one of those strolls, feeling thirsty as well as depressed, I stopped into a neighborhood watering hole called the Ivy Room and ordered a beer. The jukebox was off and the patrons were unusually silent. When the waitress put my beer in front of me and immediately turned to face the TV over the bar, I realized that everyone was watching the man I had come to save. He was pale and grave. There were dark circles under his eyes. "To where you halt this offensive build-up, a strict quarantine of all offensive equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, will be turned back." "Christ Jesus!" said a man in a cowboy hat.
What does he think the Ruskies are going to do about that?
Shut up, Bill, the bartender said. We need to hear this.
It shall be the policy of this nation, Kennedy went on, to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
A woman at the end of the bar moaned and clutched her stomach. The man beside her put an arm around her, and she put her head on his shoulder. What I saw on Kennedy's face was fright and determination in equal measure. What I also saw was life, a total engagement with the job at hand. He was exactly 13 months from his date with the assassin's bullet.
As a necessary military precaution, I have reinforced our base at Guantanamo and evacuated today the dependents of our personnel there.
Drinks for the house on me, Bill the cowboy suddenly proclaimed, because this looks like the end of the road, amigos.
He put 2 20s beside his shot glass, but the bartender made no move to pick them up. He was watching Kennedy, who was now calling on Chairman Khrushchev to eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace. The waitress who had served my beer, a road-hard and put-away wet peroxide blonde of 50 or so, suddenly burst into tears. That decided me. I got off my stool, wove my way around the tables where men and women sat looking at the television like solemn children, and slipped into one of the phone booths next to the skee-ball machine. The operator told me to deposit 40 cents for the first 3 minutes. I dropped in 2 quarters. The payphone bonged mellowly. Faintly, I could still hear Kennedy talking in that nasal New England voice. Now he was accusing Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko of being a liar. No waffling there.
"Connecting you now, sir," the operator said. Then she blurted, "Are you listening to the president? If you're not, you should turn on your TV or radio."
"I'm listening," I said.
Sadie would be too. Sadie, whose husband had spouted a lot of apocalyptic bullshit thinly coated with science. Sadie, whose Yale political friend had told her something big was going to pop in the Caribbean. A flashpoint, probably Cuba. I had no idea what I was going to say to soothe her. But that wasn't a problem. The phone rang and rang. I didn't like it. Where was she at 8:30 on a Monday night in Jody? At the movies? I didn't believe it.
"Sir, your party doesn't answer."
"I know it," I said, and grimaced when I heard Lee's pet phrase coming out of my mouth. My quarters clattered into the coin return when I hung up. I started to put them back in, then reconsidered. What good would it do to call Ms. Ellie? I was in Ms. Ellie's bad books now. Deeks, too, probably. They'd tell me to go peddle my papers.
When I walked back to the bar, Walter Cronkite was showing U-2 photos of the Soviet missile bases that were under construction. He said that many members of Congress were urging Kennedy to initiate bombing missions or launch a full-scale invasion immediately. American missile bases and the Strategic Air Command had gone to DEFCON 4 for the first time in history.
"American B-52 bombers will soon be circling just outside the Soviet Union's borders," Cronkite was saying in that deep, portentous voice of his. "And, this is obvious to all of us who've covered the last 7 years of this ever more frightening Cold War, the chances for a mistake, a potentially disastrous mistake, grow with each new escalation of..."
"Now wait," a man standing by the pool table shouted. "Bomb the living shit out of those commie cocksuckers right now."
There were a few cries of protest at this bloodthirsty sentiment, but they were mostly drowned out in a wave of applause. I left the Ivy Room and jogged back to Neely Street. When I got there,
I jumped into my Sunliner and rolled wheels for Jody. My car radio, now working again, broadcast nothing but a heaping dish of doom as I chased my headlights down Highway 77. Even the DJs had caught nuclear flu, saying things like God bless America and keep your powder dry. When the K-Life jock played Johnny Horton caterwauling the battle hymn of the Republic, I snapped it off. It was too much like the day after 9/11. I kept the pedal to the metal in spite of a Sunliner's increasingly distressed engine and the way the needle on the engine temp dial kept creeping toward H. The roads were all but deserted, and I turned into Sadie's driveway at just a little past 12:30 on the morning of the 23rd. Her yellow VW Beetle was parked in front of the closed garage doors, and the lights were on downstairs. But there was no answer when I rang the doorbell. I went around back and hammered on the kitchen door, also to no effect. I liked it less and less. She kept a spare key under the back step. I fished it out and let myself in. The unmistakable aroma of whiskey hit my nose, and the stale smell of cigarettes. "Sadie?" Nothing. I crossed the kitchen to the living room. There was an overflowing ashtray on the low table in front of the couch, and liquid soaking into the Life and Look magazine spread out there. I put my fingers into it, then raised them to my nose. Scotch. Fuck. "Sadie!" Now I could smell something else that I remembered well from Christie's binges, the sharp aroma of vomit. I ran down the short hall on the other side of the living room. There were two doors facing each other, one giving on her bedroom and the other leading to an office study. The doors were shut, but the bathroom door at the end of the hall was open. The harsh fluorescent light showed vomit splattered on the ring of the toilet bowl. There was more on the pink tile floor and the rim of the bathtub. There was a bottle of pills standing beside the soap dish on the sink. The cap was off. I ran to the bedroom. She was lying crosswise on the mussed coverlet, wearing a slip and one suede moccasin. The other had dropped off onto the floor. Her skin was the color of old candle wax, and she did not appear to be breathing. Then she took a huge snoring gasp and wheezed it back out. Her chest remained flat for a terrifying 4 seconds, then she jerked in another rattle of breath. There was another overflowing ashtray on the night table. A crumpled Winston pack, charred at one end by an imperfectly stubbed-out cigarette, lay on top of the dead soldiers. Beside the ashtray were a half-empty glass and a bottle of Glenlivet. Not much of the scotch was gone, thank God for small favors, but it wasn't really the scotch I was worried about, it was the pills. There was also a brown manila envelope on the table with what looked like photographs spilling out of it, but I didn't glance at them, not then. I got my arms around her and tried to pull her into a sitting position. The slip was silk and slithered through my hands. She thumped back onto the bed and took another of those rasping, labored breaths. Her hair flopped across one closed eye. "Sadie, wake up!" Nothing. I grabbed her by the shoulders and hauled her against the head of the bed. It thumped and shivered.
"Let me alone."
Slurry and weak, but better than nothing.
"Wake up! Sadie, you have to wake up!"
I began to slap lightly at her cheeks. Her eyes remained shut, but her hands came up and tried weakly to fend me off.
"Wake up! Wake up, damn it!"
Her eyes opened, looked at me without recognition, then shut again. But she was breathing more normally. Now that she was sitting, that terrifying rasp was gone. I went back to the bathroom, dumped her toothbrush out of the pink plastic glass, and turned on the cold tap. While I filled the glass, I looked at the label on the pill bottle, Nembutal. There were 10 or 12 capsules left, so it hadn't been a suicide attempt, at least not an overt one. I spilled them into the toilet, then ran back to the bedroom. She was sliding down from the sitting position I'd left her in, and with her head cocked forward and her chin down against her breastbone, her respiration had turned raspy again. I put the glass of water on the nightstand and froze for a second, as I got a look at one of the photographs sticking out of the envelope. It could have been a woman. What remained of the hair was long, but it was hard to tell for sure. Where the face
should have been, there was only raw meat with a hole near the bottom. The hole appeared to be screaming. I hauled Sadie up, grabbed a handful of her hair, and pulled her head back. She moaned something that might have been, "Oh, that hurts." Then I threw the glass of water in her face. She jerked, and her eyes flew open.
"George, what are you doing here? George, why am I wet?"
"Wake up! Wake up, Sadie!" I began to slap her face again, but more gently now, almost patting. It wasn't good enough. Her eyes started to slip closed.
"Go away."
"Not unless you want me to call an ambulance. That way you can see your name in the paper. The school board would love that."
"Upsadaisy!"
I managed to get my hands linked behind her and pulled her off the bed. Her slip rucked up, then fell back into place as she crumpled to her knees on the carpet. Her eyes flew open and she cried out in pain, but I got her on her feet. She swayed back and forth, slapping at my face with more strength.
"Get out! Get out, John!"
"No, ma'am." I put my arm around her waist and got her moving toward the door, half leading and half carrying her. We made the turn toward the bathroom, and then her knees came unhinged. I carried her, which was no mean feat, given her height and size. Thank God for adrenaline. I batted down the toilet ring and got her seated just before my own knees gave out. I was gasping for breath, partly from effort, mostly from fright. She started to tilt toward starboard, and I slapped her bare arm. Smack!
"Sit up!"
I shouted into her face. "Sit up! Christy, God damn it!" Her eyes fought open. They were badly bloodshot.
"Who, Christy?"
"Lead singer with the Rolling fucking Stones," I said. "How long have you been taking Nambutol, and how many did you take tonight?"
"Got a scrition," she said. "None of your business, George."
"How many? How much did you drink?"
"Go away."
I spun the tub's cold tap all the way, then pulled the pin that turned on the shower. She saw what I meant to do and once again began to slap.
"No, George, no!"
I ignored her. This wasn't the first time that I'd put a partially dressed woman into a cold shower. And some things are like riding a bike. I lifted her over the rim of the tub in a quick clean and jerk I'd feel in the small of my back the next day. Then held on tight as the cold water smacked her and she began to flail. She reached out to grab the towel bar, yelling. Her eyes were open now. Beads of water stood in her hair. The slip turned transparent. And even under such circumstances, it was impossible not to feel a moment of lust as those curves came into full view. She tried to get out. I pushed her back.
"Stand there, Sadie. Stand there and take it." How long? It's cold."
"Until I see some color come back into your cheeks."
"Why are you doing this?"
Her teeth were chattering.
"Because you almost killed yourself,"
I shouted. She flinched. Her feet slipped, but she grabbed the towel bar and stayed upright. Reflexes returning good.
"The pills weren't working, so I had a drink, that's all. Let me get out. I'm so cold. Please, George. Please, let me get out."
Her hair was clinging to her cheeks now. She looked like a drowned rat, but she was getting some color in her face. Nothing but a thin flush, but it was a start. I turned off the shower, got my arms around her in a hug, and held her as she tottered over the lip of the tub. Water from her soaked slip pattered onto the pink bath mat. I whispered into her ear, "I thought you were dead. When I came in and saw you lying there, I thought you were fucking dead. You will never know how that felt." I let her go. She stared at me with wide, wondering eyes. Then she said,
"John was right. Roger, too. He called me tonight before Kennedy's speech from Washington. So what does it matter? By this time next week, we'll all be dead. I wish we were."
At first, I had no idea what she was talking about. I saw Christy standing there, dripping and bedraggled and full of bullshit.
and I was utterly furious. "You cowardly bitch," I thought. She must have seen it in my eyes because she drew back. That cleared my head. Could I call her cowardly just because I happened to know what the landscape looked like over the horizon? I took a bath towel from the rack over the toilet and handed it to her. "Strip off, then dry off," I said. "Go out, then. Give me some privacy." "I will if you tell me you're awake." "I'm awake." She looked at me with churlish resentment and, maybe, the tiniest glint of humor. "You certainly know how to make an entrance, George." I turned to the medicine cabinet. "There aren't any more," she said. "What isn't in me is in the commode." Having been married to Christy for 4 years, I looked anyway. Then I flushed the toilet. With that business taken care of, I slipped past her to the bathroom door. "I'll give you 3 minutes," I said. The return address on the manila envelope was John Clayton, 79 East Oglethorpe Avenue, Savannah, Georgia. You certainly couldn't accuse the bastard of flying under false colors or going the anonymous route. The postmark was August 28th, so it had probably been waiting for her when she got back from Reno. She'd had nearly 2 months to brood over the contents. Had she sounded sad and depressed when I'd talked to her on the night of September 6th? Well, no wonder, given the photographs her ex had so thoughtfully sent her. "We're all in danger," she'd said the last time I spoke to her on the phone. "Johnny's right about that." The pictures were of Japanese men, women, and children, victims of the atomic bomb blasts at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or both. Some were blind. Many were bald. Most were suffering from radiation burns. A few, like the faceless woman, had been charbroiled. One picture showed a quartet of black statues in cringing postures. 4 people had been standing in front of a wall when the bomb went off. The people had been vaporized, and most of the wall had been vaporized too. The only parts that remained were the parts that had been shielded by those standing in front of it. The shapes were black because they were coated in charred flesh. On the back of each picture, he had written the same message in his clear, neat hand. "Coming soon to America. Statistical analysis does not lie." "Nice, aren't they?" Her voice was flat and lifeless. She was standing in the doorway, bundled into the towel. Her hair fell to her bare shoulders in damp ringlets. "How much did you have to drink, Sadie?" "Only a couple of shots when the pills wouldn't work. I think I tried to tell you that when you were shaking and slapping me." "If you expect me to apologize, you'll wait a long time. Barbiturates and booze are a bad combination." "It doesn't matter," she said. "I've been slapped before." That made me think of Marina, and I winced. It wasn't the same, but slapping is slapping, and I had been angry as well as scared. She went to the chair in the corner, sat down, and pulled the towel tighter around her. She looked like a sulky child. "My friend Roger Beaton called. Did I tell you that?"
"Yes."
"My good friend, Roger." Her eyes dared me to make something of it. I didn't. Ultimately, it was her life. I just wanted to make sure she had a life. "All right, your good friend Roger. He told me to be sure and watch the Irish asshole speech tonight." That's what he called him. "Then he asked me how far Jody was from Dallas. When I told him, he said that should be far enough, depending on which way the wind's blowing. He's getting out of Washington himself. Lots of people are. But I don't think it'll do him any good. You can't outrun a nuclear war." She began to cry then, harsh and wrenching sobs that shook her whole body. "Those idiots are going to destroy a beautiful world. They're going to kill children. I hate them. I hate them all. Kennedy, Khrushchev, Castro. I hope they all rot in hell." She covered her face with her hands. I knelt like some old-fashioned gentleman preparing to propose and embraced her. She put her arms around my neck and clung to me in what was almost a drowner's grip. Her body was still cold from the shower, but the cheek she laid against my arm was feverish. In that moment, I hated them all, too. John Clayton, most of all, for planting this seed in a young woman who was insecure and psychologically vulnerable. He had planted it, watered it, weeded it, and watched it grow. And was Sadie the only one in terror tonight? The only one who had turned to the pills and the booze? How hard and fast were they drinking in the ivy room right now? I'd made the stupid assumption that people were going to approach the Cuban Missile Crisis much like any other temporary international dust-up because by the time I went to college, it was just another intersection of names and dates to memorize for the next prelim. That's how things look from the future. To people in the valley, the dark valley of the present, they look different. The pictures were here when I got back from Reno. She looked at me with her bloodshot, haunted eyes. I wanted to throw them away, but I couldn't. I kept looking at them. That's what the bastard wanted. That's why he sent them. She didn't seem to hear. Statistical analysis is his hobby. He says that someday when the computers are good enough, it'll be the most important science, because statistical analysis is never wrong. Not true. In my mind's eye, I saw George de Morenschild, the charmer who was Lee's only friend. There's always a window of uncertainty. I guess the day of Johnny's supercomputers will never come, she said. The people left, if there are any, will be living in caves, and the sky? No more blue. Nuclear darkness, that's what Johnny calls it. He's full of shit, Sadie. Your pal Roger, too. She shook her head. Her bloodshot eyes regarded me sadly. Johnny knew the Russians were going to launch a space satellite. We were just out of college then. He told me in the summer, and sure enough, they put Sputnik up in October. Next, they'll send a dog or a monkey, Johnny said. After that, they'll send a man. Then, they'll send two men and a bomb. And did they do that? Did they, Sadie? They sent the dog, and they sent the man. The dog's name was Laika, remember? It died up there, poor doggy. They won't have to send up the two men and the bomb, will they? They'll use their missiles, and we'll use ours, all over a shit-pot island where they make cigars. Do you know what the magicians say? What are you talking about? They say you can fool a scientist, but you can never fool another magician. Your ex may teach science, but he's sure no magician. The Russians, on the other hand, are. You're not making sense. Johnny says the Russians have to fight, and soon, because now they have missile superiority. But they won't for long. That's why they won't back down in Cuba. It's a pretext. Johnny's seen too much newsreel footage of missiles being trundled through Red Square on May Day. What he doesn't know, and what Senator Kuchel doesn't know either, probably, is that over half of those missiles don't have engines in them. You don't. You can't. He doesn't know how many of their ICBMs blow up on their launch pads in Siberia because their rocketry guys are incompetent. He doesn't know that over half the missiles our U-2 planes have photographed are actually painted trees with cardboard fins. It's sleight of hand, Sadie. It fools scientists like Johnny and politicians like Senator Kuchel, but it would never fool another magician. It's not... She fell silent for a moment, biting at her lips. Then she said, "How could you know stuff like that?" "I can't tell you." "Then I can't believe you." Johnny said Kennedy was going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party, even though everybody else thought it was going to be Humphrey on account of Kennedy being a Catholic. He analyzed the states with primaries, ran the numbers, and he was right. He said Johnson would be Kennedy's running mate because Johnson was the only Southerner who'd be acceptable north of the Mason-Dixon line. He was right about that, too. Kennedy got in, and now he's going to kill us all.
Statistical analysis doesn't lie.
I took a deep breath. Sadie, I want you to listen to me. Very carefully. Are you awake enough to do that? For a moment, there was nothing. Then I felt her nod against my upper arm. It's now early Tuesday morning. This standoff is going to go on for another 3 days, or maybe it's four. I can't remember.
What do you mean you can't remember?
I mean there's nothing about this in Al's notes, and my only college class in American history was almost 20 years ago. It's amazing I can remember as much as I do.
We're going to blockade Cuba, but the only Russian ship we'll stop won't have anything in it but food and trade goods. The Russians are going to bluster, but by Thursday or Friday, they're going to be scared to death and looking for a way out.
One of the big Russian diplomats will initiate a back-channel meeting with some TV guy. And seemingly from nowhere, the way crossword puzzle answers sometimes come to me, I remembered the name, or almost remembered it. His name is John Scolari, something like that.
Scully? Are you talking about John Scully on the ABC News?
Yeah, that's him. This is going to happen Friday or Saturday, while the rest of the world, including your ex and your pal from Yale, is just waiting for the word to stick their heads between their legs and kiss their asses goodbye. She heartened me by giggling. This Russian will more or less say... Here I did a pretty good Russian accent. I'd learned it listening to Lee's wife, also from Boris and Natasha on Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Get word to your president that we won't wait to back out of this with honor. You agree, take your nuclear missiles out of Turkey. You promise never to invade Cuba. We say okay and dismantle missiles in Cuba.
And that, Sadie, is exactly what's going to happen.
She wasn't giggling now. She was staring at me with huge saucer eyes.
You're making this up to make me feel better.
I said nothing.
You're not, she whispered. You really believe it?
Wrong, I said. I know it.
Big difference. George, nobody knows the future.
John Clayton claims to know and you believe him.
Roger from Yale claims to know and you believe him too.
You're jealous of him, aren't you?
You're goddamn right.
I never slept with him. Never even wanted to. Solemnly, she added, I could never sleep with a man who wears that much cologne.
Good to know. I'm still jealous.
Should I ask questions about how you...
No, I won't answer them.
I probably shouldn't have told her as much as I had, but I couldn't stop myself, and in truth, I would do it again.
But I will tell you one other thing, and this you can check yourself in a couple of days.
Adlai Stevenson and the Russian representative to the UN are going to face off in the General Assembly. Stevenson's going to exhibit huge photos of the missile bases the Russians are building in Cuba and ask the Russian guy to explain what the Russians said wasn't there. The Russian guy is going to say something like, "You must wait, I cannot respond without full translation." And Stevenson, who knows the guy can speak perfect English, is going to say something that'll wind up in the history books along with "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes." He's going to tell the Russian guy he can wait until hell freezes over.
She looked at me doubtfully, turned to the night table, saw the charred pack of Winstons sitting on top of a hill of crushed butts, and said,
"I think I'm out of cigarettes."
"You should be okay until morning," I said dryly. "It looks to me like you front-loaded about a week's supply."
"George," her voice was very small, very timid, "will you stay with me tonight? My car's parked in your... If one of the neighborhood neb-noses says something, I'll tell them you came to see me after the president's speech and it wouldn't start." Considering how the Sunliner was running these days, that was plausible.
"Does your sudden concern for propriety mean you've stopped worrying about nuclear Armageddon?"
"I don't know.
I only know I don't want to be alone.
I'll even make love with you if that'll get you to stay, but I don't think it would be much good for either of us. My head aches so badly. You don't have to make love to me, hon. It's not a business deal. I didn't mean... Hush. I'll get the aspirin. And look on top of the medicine cabinet, would you? Sometimes I leave a pack of cigarettes there. She had. But by the time she'd taken three puffs of the one I lit for her, she was wall-eyed and dozing. I took it from between her fingers and mashed it out on the lower slope of Mount Cancer. Then I took her in my arms and laid back on the pillows. We fell asleep that way. When I woke to the first long light of dawn, the fly of my slacks was unzipped, and a skillful hand was exploring inside my underwear. I turned to her. She was looking at me calmly. "The world is still here, George, and so are we. Come on, but be gentle. My head still aches." I was gentle, and I made it last. We made it last. At the end, she lifted her hips and dug into my shoulder blades. It was her, "Oh, dear, oh, my God, oh, sugar," grip. "Anything," she was whispering, her breath in my ear, making me shiver as I came. "You can be anything, do anything. Just say you'll stay and that you still love me." Sadie, I never stopped. We had breakfast in her kitchen before I went back to Dallas. I told her it really was Dallas now, and although I didn't have a phone yet, I would give her the number as soon as I had one. She nodded and picked at her eggs. "I meant what I said. I won't ask any more questions about your business." "That's best. Don't ask. Don't tell." "Huh? Never mind. Just tell me again that you're up to good rather than no good." "Yes," I said, "I'm one of the good guys." "Will you be able to tell me someday?" "I hope so," I said. "Sadie, those pictures he sent, I tore them up this morning. I don't want to talk about them." "We don't have to. But I need you to tell me that's all the contact you've had with him, that he hasn't been around." "He hasn't been, and the postmark on the envelope was Savannah." I'd noticed that, but I'd also noticed the postmark was almost 2 months old. "He's not big on personal confrontation. He's brave enough in his mind, but I think he's a physical coward." That struck me as a good assessment. Sending the pictures was textbook passive-aggressive behavior. Still, she'd been sure Clayton wouldn't find out where she was now living and teaching, and she'd been wrong about that. "The behavior of mentally unstable people is hard to predict, honey. If you saw him, you'd call the police, right?" "Yes, George," with a touch of her old impatience. "I need to ask you one question. Then we won't talk about this anymore until you're ready, if you ever are." "Okay?" I tried to prepare an answer to the question I was sure would be coming. "Are you from the future, George?" "It's going to sound crazy." "It's been a crazy night. Go ahead." "Are you..." She laughed and started to gather the plates. She went to the sink with them, and with her back turned, she asked, "Are you human? Like, from planet Earth?" I went to her, reached around to cup her breasts, and kissed the back of her neck. "Totally human." She turned. Her eyes were grave. "Can I ask another?" I sighed. "Shoot. I've got at least 40 minutes before I have to dress for school. Do you happen to have another condom? I think I've discovered the cure for headaches." Chapter 20. So in the end, it only took the threat of nuclear war to bring us back together. How romantic is that? Okay, maybe not. Dick Simmons, the sort of man who took an extra hanky to sad movies, approved heartily. Ellie Doherty did not. Here's a strange thing I've noticed. Women are better at keeping secrets, but men are more comfortable with them. A week or so after the Cuban Missile Crisis ended, Ellie called Sadie into her office and shut the door. Not a good sign. She was typically blunt, asking Sadie if she knew any more about me than she had before. No, Sadie said. But you've begun again. Yes. Do you even know where he lives? No, but I have a telephone number. Ellie rolled her eyes, and who could blame her? Has he told you anything at all about his past? Whether he's been married before? Because I believe that he has been. Sadie stayed silent. Has he happened to mention if he's left a dropped calf or two behind somewhere? Because sometimes men do that, and a man who's done it once will not hesitate to... Miss Ellie, may I go back to the library now? I've left a student in charge, and while Helen's very responsible, I don't like to leave them too. Go, go, Ellie flapped a hand at the door. I thought you liked George, Sadie said as she got up. I do, Ellie replied, in a tone Sadie told me later that said, I did. I'd like him even better, and like him for you better, if I knew what his real name was and what he's up to. Don't ask, don't tell, Sadie said as she went to the door. What's that supposed to mean? That I love him. That he saved my life. That's all I have to give him in return is my trust, and I intend to give it. Miss Ellie was one of those women accustomed to getting the last word in most situations. But she didn't get it that time. We fell into a pattern that fall and winter. I would drive down to Jody on Friday afternoons. Sometimes on the way I would buy flowers at the florist in Round Hill. Sometimes I'd get my hair cut at the Jody Barber Shop, which was a great place to catch up on all the local chatter. Also, I'd gotten used to having it short. I could remember wearing it so long it flopped to my eyes, but not why I'd put up with the annoyance. Getting used to jockey shorts over boxers was harder, but after a while my balls no longer claimed to be strangling. We'd usually eat at Al's Diner on those evenings, then go to the football game. And when the football season ended, there was basketball. Sometimes Deke joined us, decked out in his school sweater with Brian the Fightin' Denton Lion on the front. Miss Ellie? Never. Her disapproval did not stop us from going to the Candlewood bungalows after the Friday games. I usually stayed there alone on Saturday nights, and on Sundays I joined Sadie for services at Jody's First Methodist Church. We shared a hymnal and sang many verses of Bringing in the Sheaves. Sowing in the morning, sowing seeds of kindness. The melody and those well-meant sentiments still linger in my head. After church, we'd have the noon meal at her place, and after that I'd drive back to Dallas. Every time I made that drive, it seemed longer, and I liked it less. Finally, on a chilly day in mid-December, my Ford threw a rod as if expressing its own opinion that we were driving in the wrong direction. I wanted to get it fixed. That Sunliner convertible was the only car I ever truly loved. But the guy at Killeen Auto Repair told me it would take a whole new engine, and he just didn't know where he could lay his paws on one. I dug into my still sturdy, well, relatively sturdy cash reserve, and bought a 1959 Chevy, the kind with the bodacious gull-wing tail fins. It was a good car, and Sadie said she absolutely adored it, but for me, it was never quite the same. We spent Christmas night together at the Candlewood. I put a sprig of holly on the dresser and gave her a cardigan. She gave me a pair of loafers that are on my feet now. Some things are meant to keep. We had dinner at her house on Boxing Day, and while I was setting the table, Deke's ranch wagon pulled into the driveway. That surprised me, because Sadie had said nothing about company. I was more surprised to see Miss Ellie on the passenger side. The way she stood with her arms folded, looking at my new car, told me I wasn't the only one who'd been kept in the dark about the guest.